6:30 minutes, I'm going to go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, stories that keep you informed and in the loop. Coming up on the program today, the IDT bribery scandal, what it teaches us about corruption, media pressure and the cost of silencing the truth. Stats SA ramps up efforts to measure South Africa's invisible workforce in the informal sector. New car sales hit a six-year high. Is it consumer confidence or a credit bubble? And backing women in business isn't a charity. It's a new high-return investment strategy. It's Thursday, the 14th of August. Well, I'm sure you've seen the footage. An undercover video has laid bare a brazen bid to silence the media. Suspended Independent Development Trust Chief Executive Officer Tebogo Malaka and the organization's spokesperson caught offering investigative journalist Pieter Louis Meiburg 60,000 rand in cash to bury a damaging story about tender kickbacks. The footage released by the Daily Maverick has predictably ignited outrage, has prompted criminal charges, and is raising urgent questions about corruption and the lengths that some will go to evade accountability. Pieter Louis Meiburg is with me now, and a very warm welcome. And I'm interested to know, Pieter, having reflected on this for a couple of days now, why you believe they chose to offer a bribe instead of other forms of damage control. It suggests to me that your investigation was nearing some kind of breakthrough.
Hi, Jeremy. Yes, no, absolutely. Look, so on Monday, we published the investigation into Malaka's property. Which was clearly the matter that they had hoped to bury by making that offer. So evidently, you know, the issues we unpack in this piece is very damning and very damaging. Malaka had these dealings with Colin Mashawana, this businessman we mentioned in the report, and clearly all of those financial dealings sort of revolved around the IDT and Ms. Malaka's role as the IDT CEO, which obviously, you know, poses very serious questions in terms of her conduct and the influence she had over the awarding of government contracts or IDT contracts to the likes of Mashawana's entity. So certainly, look, it was a very, very desperate act. I think they certainly hoped that, you know, anybody, I think, you know, possibly in their world, when they do make these offers, probably it's happened before, and generally people do say yes, and it seems to be the kind of default manner in which they try and douse these flames when crises emerge.
What was your initial reaction when the offer was made?
I was still shocked. Like, so I'm clearly sure you from were. The way we presented all of this, it was weeks in the making, right? So, I mean, this was a journalistic sting operation. We can call it that much. Yeah. We planned for it as soon as the initial offers or intimations were made back in June, when I was first contacted by the IDT spokesperson on behalf of Malaka. That was the moment we decided to henceforth approach this as a journalistic project and prepare for it. So we assumed it was coming, we suspected it was coming, but still, you know, when that bundle was put on the table, it's still a pretty shocking moment.
And with the benefit of a bit of hindsight now, how do you assess the implications of this attempt?
Look, so as you mentioned there, the criminal investigations will now get underway, hopefully. We have seen a very annoying and frustrating inaction in the past, even when very clear-cut cases of corruption and bribery, etc., are, you know, put in the public domain. Let's hope it's a little bit different this time. I mean, that video evidence is very compelling. So let's hope that's what will happen. But I think the other thing to watch is the IDT, you know, it's a space where, you know, billions of rands in public funds are spent every year on these sort of public upliftment projects, social upliftment projects, building clinics and schools and things like that. I think the broader question now is, if this had been going on under Ms. Malaka's, you know, reign as CEO, what else was happening there? I mean, we did detail that 800 million rand oxygen plants contract last year. That was one other example of malfeasance. So one has to wonder, you know, how deep is the rot at the IDT? There is a new board in place, under a new board chairperson. I do have high hopes for their intentions. They seem to make all the right noises in terms of cleaning house. And Yeah, let's see what their probes reveal as they delve into IDT contracts.
I also think this is a bit of a watershed moment in the relationship, perhaps, between government and the media in South Africa, because it really does raise a broader issue of the brazen nature of corruption in this country and the lengths to which people will go to cover it up.
Yeah, no, definitely. Look, so this is absolutely unprecedented. And I think what it does confirm is there have been long been suspicions that journalists, or some journalists, hopefully just, a select few of them, are on the take for various reasons, for covering up stories, for driving agendas against, politicians or other public figures, for all sorts of nefarious reasons. We heard some of those details at the Zondo Commission, for instance, and those names were never revealed. But I think what this has just really sort of brought into sharp focus again is that, yes, this clearly is something that does happen. I really suspect that this was not their first attempt to interact with a journalist like this. And I also strongly suspect it's not that the IDT is not the only place where this is happening. So it definitely has opened a whole new debate around that. And we have to remain vigilant because the last thing this industry, media space can afford is losing, further credibility. There's already sort of a credibility deficit globally, a distrust in media institutions, and we can't afford to lose face.
Have you received any threats?
No. So, but we remain vigilant and we'll be very watchful going forward because my work on this issue is also continuing. We'll be publishing more details on this IDT contract and probably more broadly on the IDT. And we'll always be sort of careful and keep our ear on the ground.
Philosophically, I guess it also raises the question about what changes, whether they be legal, institutional, or even cultural, are needed to prevent such brazen acts of corruption and to protect journalists who are simply doing a public interest investigation. Or do you think we've reached some kind of precipice point where it's going to be difficult to do anything, that we've just got to live within a new paradigm?
Yeah, look, I think we should definitely not accept the fact that this is the paradigm and we should just kind of like passively sit back and accept it because, I mean, that is a sure one-way journey into absolute chaos, procurement-wise, the whole kind of like public infrastructure procurement system. We cannot accept that. So my answer always is that the reason why this does happen, and there's such brazenness, is because we haven't seen any real action when corruption issues are exposed. We've had the Zondo Commission, which was supposed to be this massive cathartic moment in terms of airing corruption, and it was supposed to be, fallout from that. But the fallout has been minimal in terms of criminal prosecution. And as soon as you get that going in a real and concrete and substantial way, then that'll start acting as a deterrent. But currently, there isn't really one because all that happens when individuals get involved in these kind of scandals is they lose their jobs at worst, and then sometimes pop up at other government institutions.
So why is there a lack of action then?
It's just the criminal justice system is still completely broken from the Jacob Zuma state capture years. It's been hollowed out. They don't have the capacity to deal with this sort of corruption. There aren't enough investigators. There's not enough expertise in those institutions to tackle and trace complex money laundering and corruption cases that require quite significant forensic ability and capabilities. So the organization is also underfunded. There's not enough funding being channeled to the NPA specialist corruption body, the IDAC, the IDAC. Many problems broadly relating to the incapacity of the NPA still persist.
It is a huge problem, and thank you for shedding some light on it. Pieter Louis Myburgh, investigative journalist, Daily Maverick, thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africa's jobs picture could soon look very different, or at least on paper. Stats South Africa is overhauling its quarterly labour force survey from the third quarter, fine-tuning how it measures informal work and underemployment. The aim, I understand, is to capture a more accurate snapshot of the country's shifting labour market. That would include street traders and gig workers, all in line with the latest international standards. I'm keen to talk about that, but this announcement also comes as today's fresh jobs data Peter Lance, and that offers a look, or a last look, at employment trends before the new methodology kicks in. I'm in conversation now with the Statistician General, Risenga Maluleki. Risenga, a very warm welcome to you. Let's start with today's data. The unemployment rate has risen to 33.2%. Any sense of what is driving this increase, despite more people, it seems, being employed?
Jeremy, let us start by saying that what makes employment gains or unemployment gains differs from quarter to quarter. However, what we have been seeing in our country is that unemployment has been rising steadily higher. So obviously, there is an issue of people who are entering the job market. Just beginning of this year, first quarter, we saw a number of people coming from high school as well as university entering the job market. But what in this quarter particularly drove unemployment percentage to go higher is because the number of the employed people did not increase much. In the first quarter, we were sitting at 16.8 million. We only went up by 19,000, and we went back still to 16.8 million people. Whereas on the unemployed side, first quarter, we were sitting at 8.2 million unemployed, that is actively looking for employment. That number went up by 140,000 to 8.4 million. So we have seen more people actively looking for employment increasing than the number of people that are employed increasing. That is what has driven this increase by 0.3 of a percentage point to 33.2%.
So if we have discouraged work seekers down, surely that should translate into a sharper drop in the unemployment rate, though?
Well, what we see is that, remember, when you look at the headline number, 33.2%, you don't include the discouraged work seekers. So what we have seen is that the discouraged work seekers were sitting at 3.5 million. They went down by 28,000. They dropped to 3.4 million. But those discouraged work seekers went to actively look for employment. So this is what we, the headline unemployment rate looks at people who were actively looking for employment. Now, when we take that 8.4 million plus 3.4 million who are your discouraged work seekers, plus another 800,000 who didn't look for employment, not because they were discouraged, but they had other reasons, we come to 12.6 million. That is what we call the expanded unemployment rate, which is sitting at 42.9%.
The concern is steadfast, I think, is that youth unemployment remains at 46.1%. I'm interested to know why there's been no movement in spite of more young people, if I've read the numbers correctly, actually finding work.
Well, one of the things that we should understand when it comes to youth unemployment is that they are the drivers of an increase in the number of the people that are unemployed. So let us look at it this way. Every year, the beginning of the year, you have more young people who come into the job market. Whether they are employed or not, it's something else. And once they come in, some will decide they are going to school. But if they don't get admitted, they then go and look for employment. And when they go and look for employment, they don't get employed. Their unemployment rate increases, or in some cases, quarter on quarter may remain the same.
Now, let's look at this provincially. Gauteng and the Eastern Cape gaining jobs, the Western Cape and KwaZulu-Natal seeing steep losses. Are you able to briefly tell me what explains these stark provincial contrasts?
For starters, different provinces have different takes when it comes to the industries of the economy. So let us look at Gauteng, for example, as well as Gauteng and the Western Cape. They are strongest economy. Their economies are driven largely by your finance, real estate, and other business services. And then from there, it's retail. So retail is usually centered around your city centers. So particularly, the Western Cape also has a strong emphasis of agriculture. And as we have seen, contrasted with Gauteng, agriculture lost 24,000 jobs. So in the loss of 24,000 jobs, including other industries, the Western Cape lost 117,000 jobs. Whereas Gauteng doesn't have much in terms of trade. It is driven by trade as well as because of its larger population volume, it has what we call private households. And that then drives the gains that we have seen. In trade, we have seen 88,000 jobs being gained, Jeremy, followed by private household sitting at 28,000.
Let me reference very quickly the quarterly labor force survey, and there are key changes in the questionnaire. I'm interested to know going forward how these changes are going to impact our understanding of unemployment, particularly among younger South Africans, as we've just been discussing.
I don't see the changes or the improvements in the questionnaire going to change the jobs that are being created or the jobs that are being lost. What we see, we will see, and the changes that we make usually help us to disaggregate further on issues of unemployment, underemployment, and other issues. So I don't foresee, it's like when you go to a neighborhood that has 100 people employed and another 10 people unemployed, and you ask further questions to understand more of their attributes, it won't change the unemployment numbers, but it will improve on disaggregation and reporting.
Was there pressure to change the survey format because of criticism from the outgoing chief executive of Capitec?
Certainly not, Jeremy. What has happened over time, we are part of the international labor conferences, and improvements have been done since we introduced the labor force survey for more than for almost 2 decades. And particularly since 2008, we have been putting improvements from time to time. So one thing that we should not do, as Stats say, is we do appreciate issues that are raised by members of the public, and we did go to meet with this the former CEO of Capitec together with his management, and we have agreed on how we could work together going forward. However, Stats say should resist the temptation that when people raise issues, it is because the numbers are wrong. It gives us an opportunity to explain our methods as well as telling them what we will do as improvements. But it's not driven by that. One of the things we should not do as a country is that we will make a big mistake as a country if we think this country doesn't have an unemployment challenge. And Stats SA doesn't have to tell South Africans what they want to hear. We have to tell them the snapshot, the picture as it is. And that means that we should not buckle under pressure.
Yeah, the unvarnished truth is critical in this respect. That's the Statistician General, Risenga Maluleke. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africa's new vehicle sales, it seems, are in overdrive, up over 15.5% year on year in July to more than 51,000 units. That's the strongest showing since before the pandemic. While lower interest rates and rising disposable income may be part of the story, TransUnion Africa's latest Mobility Insights report is suggesting a deeper consumer recovery is underway. That's good news. But behind the glossy sales numbers, I think there are still big questions about affordability, about credit behavior, and whether the boom can outlast the current economic headwinds that we are experiencing. Chief Executive Officer of TransUnion is Lee Nike, and he joins me on the program now. Lee, July surge then, if I've read this correctly, is the biggest in nearly 6 years. But how much of it is genuine market strength, and perhaps how much is just pent-up demand that is finally being released?
Jeremy, that's a really good question. I think the answer is more complex to consider. The market generally works in cycles, and for a long time post the pandemic, we've had a tough household income scenario where customers have held back on purchases, worrying about the fragility of the economy. But as things have stabilized, specifically as inflation has gotten into hand, into a position where the SARB is happy enough to give us interest rate declines, we've seen that consumers have done two things. One, they've actually become quite better at managing their credit agreements. And secondly, as they've now had access to more disposable income, it's given them the ability to actually take on new credit. There's something worth calling out immediately, specifically in NAMSA's vehicle data. We cannot avoid talking about the advancement of Chinese vehicles in South Africa that have challenged the entire industry for providing vehicles that are a whole lot cheaper. And customers that have never thought of buying vehicles before, Jeremy, are now in the market for vehicles.
I appreciate the optimism, but I can't help but wonder whether this isn't perhaps a false dawn, given the economic headwinds that we're currently facing or are about to experience.
Well, it is interesting. So we're currently forecasting some 1.4 to 1.5% GDP. I firmly agree with your view, specifically with US tariffs potentially being contemplated. I think a series of events that started in the middle of last year shows the current positivity. It's the drawdowns from the two-pot retirement savings. It's the decline of interest rates. There's a general view that says things are pretty good right now. Of course, like yourself, we need to be cautiously optimistic about the future. But I would say, though, given the small reductions in interest rate, it has put additional disposable income in the households. But as part of your concern, I fully agree that if we don't responsibly use this extra money we have at our household to service debt, we could perpetuate what was a bad situation just a few months ago.
So the danger is not to treat this as a short-term credit sugar rush.
100%. You know, we've been in this industry for 125 years as TransUnion. And what is interesting to note is you always need to assume that things could be worse than they are today. We could go from an interest rate decline cycle and turn the corner quite quickly. We need to be able to have some buffer. And as we've often spoken about over the years, is South Africa doesn't have a savings culture. We are highly indebted from a debt perspective. So some 62% of household income still goes towards servicing debt. It's somewhat down over the last few quarters. People have serviced down their debt. But the truth is we are highly indebted, meaning if there's a change in inflation, if the food basket price goes up or interest rates go up, it will affect the households. It's a balancing act. What we are seeing in the data you started the conversation with is that there has been an increase in vehicle sales, but for a variety of reasons. It's the consumer optimism. It is the advancement of better deals as new cars are in the cycle of deals. This is the time when consumers could access better opportunity. But in all of this, we need to always assume that it is potential that things could get tougher. And when things get tougher, people that can barely afford an expensive vehicle should hold back and buy something well within their range.
One figure leaps out at me. 39% of insured vehicle owners are financing their cars. Does it say anything about who's actually buying? But perhaps more importantly, Lee, who's being locked out of the market?
Well, it's a really interesting data point. So arguably, the people that are buying cars are not Jeremy Maggs and Lee Nike. Over the last few quarters, we've seen very, very clearly it's the individuals that make up what we call Generation Y and Generation Z that are actually driving up the actual vehicle sales in South Africa. In fact, of all of the segments of our population, this is the most optimistic group about our future. So the data tells us that in the 39% of insured vehicles, of those that have insured, only 39% have some form of finance. It tells us a few things. It tells us, one, that post the pandemic, people are less materialistic, specifically in the Generation X and the baby boomers category. It tells us that people are holding onto vehicles for a longer period of time. It also tells us that that because insurance isn't a mandatory thing in South Africa, not as many people take up insurance. But the one compelling data point that's been coming out for many quarters now is that the youth are talking, the youth are wanting to move out of this high unemployment rate. And in all the research we've done, there's a tight correlation between transport poverty and financial poverty. And there's a link that says if we can get moving again, we can access opportunities in the economy.
And Lee, just a final one, and I want to circle back to the inroads the Chinese auto marques are making into South Africa. Is it a stretch to say that brand loyalty now is dead in the face of affordability pressures?
Brand loyalty is 100% dead. This actually happened, you know, back in the pandemic, we believe, when our priorities changed from materialistic things to healthcare and personal and family wellness. We now know that as opposed to having a certain model of a luxury brand, we just want to get into a car to access opportunity. It's the very same reason where we've seen all over the road these Bajaj Qutes that are actually a form of transport, whereas in an X or a Black was the way we did it previously. So I think we are talking more pragmatically about accessing transport and mobility to access opportunity versus the color and the stripes on your vehicle. So I think this pattern will actually continue. And for the traditional players from a finance and from a manufacturer perspective, I'm expecting them to have to disrupt their commercial models to make it more lucrative to get access to what is quite a driven youth sector that wants access to cars.
Lee Naik, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer, TransUnion Africa.
Smart minds, big moves, one summit. Join the country's leading thinkers, doers and decision makers at the MoneyWeb Money Summit. It's happening on the 9th of September at the Sandton Convention Centre. It's one full day of powerful insights, real opportunities and bold conversations shaping South Africa's economic future. And the best part, your ticket is free. Just use the code MoneyWebGuest when you register. Visit moneysummit.co.za now. MoneyWeb Money Summit, where smart money moves. You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, female-owned SMEs make up just over 1 in 5 formal businesses in South Africa, but research shows they often deliver higher returns, stronger community impact, and more resilient growth than male-led counterparts. Susan Moloisani, Chief Executive Officer of Edge Growth Solutions, argues that supporting female entrepreneurs is, in her words, a moral imperative and a business opportunity. But here's the rub. Systemic barriers, from biased funding decisions to exclusion from value chains, are keeping this potential locked away. So let's unravel all of this. Susan, a very warm welcome to you. Do you think that corporates and funders then are maybe guilty of paying lip service to gender empowerment, but are not embedding it into procurement and investment strategies? Is that the nub of your argument?
Jeremy, thank you for having me. Yes, in part. So I think there's a lot that has been done over the years to remedy, you know, some of the systemic challenges or injustices of the past that we've seen that relate to women particularly. So there's definitely been traction that has been made both by corporates and other organizations outside of the corporate sphere. However, that investment has not yet yielded the kind of result that we'd expect, given where we are and the amount of investment that has already been put out there in support of women-led entrepreneurs. So in a nutshell, there's been stuff that have been done, but that stuff is not yet enough to create the kind of impact that we would like to see at this point.
So I don't want to get too philosophical here, but how much of the problem, in your opinion, is structural? And I'm talking about collateral requirement, maybe network exclusion, or is it simply rooted in unconscious bias when it comes to funding decisions?
I think there's a little bit of both. So the reason I say that is because we know from the statistics that you've quoted and the ones that are available, widely available out there, that we don't have an issue of performance when it comes to women-led businesses. The actual issue is around perception. And that perception is rooted fundamentally in some of the like historical context that we know that we have as a world, really, not just a country. And then that has led to some of the ways that the ecosystem has been structured in a way that has had unintended consequences in certain instances of exclusion of women-led businesses. So I think it's actually a bit of both. There are those unconscious biases that still exist, because in some of these rooms, you largely have representation still by men over women. And so those unconscious biases then show up in those kind of environments. From a structural perspective, you do have, you know, like issues around like limited access to that collateral, like the one that you quoted. You have issues around just like the role of women in society and how they're constantly having to balance growing businesses, for example, with caregiving responsibilities, etc. So all of these factors contribute to where we find ourselves and are worth like considering when we're thinking about how to actually figure out what the solutions need to be going forward.
So if you're going to figure it out, then what, in your opinion, is the single biggest intervention that would move the needle fastest for female entrepreneurs?
I think the single biggest needle is to have people that are also females on the other side of the table. Mm. So if we're thinking about investors, we need to see more female investors, like assessing female deals, and we need to see corporate supply chains being led more by women that have inherently a bias towards considering some of the things that are specific to women. So I think the single biggest thing would be the inclusion of women across the entire ecosystem to provide people that have an understanding of like the unique challenges faced by women, interacting with women at the critical points where like investment is being considered or growth is being supported.
I absolutely accept the argument, but it's also about return on investment, and the difficulty, the challenge is convincing, I imagine, skeptical investors that diversity is a return enhancing factor and not just a tick box or a compliance exercise.
Absolutely, but like we had mentioned earlier on, there's no shortage of statistics and evidence that this is not just a moral imperative, it's actually a business imperative. Like on multiple fronts, women entrepreneurs perform much better than male-owned entrepreneurs. There's statistics out there that show us that businesses that survive longer than 5 years are more likely to be businesses that are led by women, which is giving us an indication of like sustainability of the kind of business that is women-led versus one that is male-led. We've got statistics that tell us in certain sectors that women-owned businesses produce return on investments that are far greater than those of their male counterparts. So again, there's no shortage of evidence, proven evidence of women-owned businesses not just being like the support of them not just being that of a moral imperative, but a business imperative, because the performance is there. So there's no lack of performance. The issue is a perception issue, not a performance issue in my mind.
And just finally, the problem, I imagine, is also not enough targeted action in so-called high growth, high margin sectors. The reality is that women are often funneled into safe industries, which means lower margins.
100%. And so I think going back to like what are some of the solutions systemically that could assist with that is having mandates like from an investment perspective that are targeted at females or have a gender lens in their investment strategies. It is having support organizations in the ecosystem that are targeted at accelerating and incubating women-led businesses. So all of those, in my mind, would be ways that will start to help us shift the needle a little bit more in the right direction to kind of counter what we're seeing at the moment.
Thank you very much indeed. I've been talking to Susan Molosani, Chief Executive Officer of Edge Growth Solutions. And that is where we're going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.